Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
And on this Thanksgiving Eve, we begin with a little prayer. Damn that cloud. Stop the prayer. Stop the prayer. Start the prayer. Piano came through like a knife. That's kind of loud. Stop it. You tell how often I pray. Start the prayer. Ah, nice teasing. Melodic.
How about getting off of these antibiotics? How about stopping eating when I'm full of?
Usher us in here on a Thanksgiving Eve here on Somatime. I'm your host, Dr. Mark. The number to call to participate, to contribute, to enhance the listener's experience, 646-478-4847. Wow, I've made it to Thanksgiving Eve. Boy, what a lonely, long, horrible year this has been. Thank you! Boy, and what have I got to show for it? Mm-hmm. Boy, everything's a little sluggish out of the shit.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have something else because, of course, now we are way past the point of having our swine flu update. But yeah, we still have our song. Let's begin the show with this.
Son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was
going to
say, son of a bitch,
didn't you? Mhm. Yeah, we're moving away from our swine friend because, you know, it's proven to be an imposter. But deep in the Ukraine, there's something a little amiss. So what I want to do tonight, I'm going to fish around, find some other stuff towards the end of the show once we get past our guest and pause and reflect on what we've learned tonight. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to start the show by giving you guys a little homework. You know, you're sitting around getting over your tryptophan, you know, toxicity as you gobble up the turkeys tomorrow. Yum. And here's a little list. Just a little list. Little list. I might add to it later, but here's the list right now. Write down these words. All right? And, you know, maybe you make it a little game. You know, you sit there with your little blackberries and your little texting each other when you're 4 feet away from each other, as we're going to get into in a minute with our guest. And write down these words. Just see what it leads you to conclude, okay? First word, climate gate. Climate gate, okay? Second word, Verichip. V-E-R-I, chip. Third little grouping, steel vault. As it relates to Verichip. Fourth little phrase, Baxter International Laboratory. It is in the Ukraine. Okay? Those are easy. Now here's another couple of curveballs for you. Agenda 21. I'll say it again. Agenda 21. And the final phrase for the beginning of the show here. Copenhagen Summit. Copenhagen Summit. Otherwise known as the Cap and Trade Agreement. So, what do all those things have to do with people dropping dead in the Ukraine? Maybe we'll get into that later. But right now, before we get our guest on the air, I promised I'd do this, so let's just find it here. Let's see if we can get the latest lines. We have some Turkey Day football to get to here, and I know you gambling degenerates out there need my picks, as I've promised on the preview on Facebook. And in front of me on Facebook, I'm over there, under Mark Filippi, not under Soma Boy, as I am on Twitter. I am under Soma Boy, as I pontificate on the benefits of being somatically aware. All right, so tomorrow we have our friends in Detroit, where unemployment, I think, is about, what, 40%? I think the game was going to be shown last week. They played Cleveland, and the game was not shown, and it was like the best game of the week, even though the two teams are in drift. But anyway, we have Green Bay spotting 11.5 at Detroit. Green Bay a little banged up, kind of an eco team with an eco quarterback. I don't know who's starting for the Lions. The guy that the rookie that was in there last week was his shoulder was dangling from a thread at the end of the game. But I think Detroit's going to cover. I think they're going to play close, and I'm rooting for them because I hate Green Bay. I've always hated them, and they're only a game behind the Giants, so I'll be rooting for Detroit in that first game. That's an early game, 12:30 kick. So my take is Detroit in the points. In the 4:15 game, when you're coming out of your first haze, when you're taking your nap and you got that full belly, usually that first half of that 4 o'clock game, you got one eye open. Then you get a little saucy there in the second half of the game. We got Dallas hosting the Oakland Raiders, fresh from the victory over the Bengals last week, spotting a big 13.5. Dallas' offense, I don't think it scored, 14 points in the last two games. So I am taking the Raiders. Not only to cover, but to win, because, like Green Bay, I hate Dallas a lot more. So there you go. I'm probably going to get smeared, but, you know, this is my every year with the Green Bay and the Dallas thing. I can't stand it. I mean, Detroit and Dallas. Anyway, but tomorrow night, in the wilds of Denver, Colorado, high above the sea level, the New York Football Giants are spotting 6.5 to the Denver Broncos, who have lost four straight. Now, knowing from my own personal experience rooting for the Giants, they just lost four straight. And you know, when you have one in over a month, you start to doubt yourself. And they've got injuries. They've got inner chaos going on in that team. You know, this is a team that overachieved early, and then they come back to earth. I think for the most part, we're going to see a nip-and-tuck game. And for the Giants to cover 6.5, it's going to require Denver imploding. But I am going to pick my Giants, because, you know, I'm a sucker for punishment. So there you go. There's my picks. I got Detroit with the 11.5. I've got Oakland with the 13.5. And the G-men spotting 6.5 at Denver. Your mileage may differ. So there you go. All right. Look, our guest is here. It's nick of time. So I'm going to get the submarine dock here. And joining us, a soon-to-be snowy and rainy northeast corridor of the United States up near the Beantown area, I believe. It's 404 area code. I don't know if that's in Boston, but should be around there. Is Eric Wallman, author of Socialnomics. Welcome to Summertime.
Thanks for having me here. Definitely, I am in Boston right now.
Okay. Oh, this is your cell. Because 404 is like Atlanta, right?
It is Atlanta. Yeah, I've kept the Atlanta cell phone.
Oh, yeah. His industrious past down in with Earthlink. So, now, you're gonna settle this for me, because I've been doing this since last week's show, and I don't think my eyes have blinked since I started finding this information. You are, as they say, media savvy, social media specifically, right?
Yes.
So when a story comes out, now it could be a news story, it could be a sports story, it could be any kind of a story, there's what they call a news cycle, right? And with all the media that's come out in the last, say, 5 years, I won't even go back to the Stone Age, there's been a sort of a groundswell. You know, you go back into the old days, you know, when Drudge was the only guy doing it, and there's been a lot of basically sort of, we'll just call it, news has become a participatory sport. Like, people are scooping each other. And when something comes out that doesn't get a lot of light, that gets kind of pushed to the side, you get a little bit, you know, you look at it now like something's behind that curtain. I want to know. What do you know, or what have you heard, or what has been rumored, or what has been proven and is on the beach, and we could weigh it, about this so-called pneumonic flu in the Ukraine? Anything.
Anything on the pneumonic plague in the Ukraine?
Yes. You're not aware of it?
I'm not aware of that, no.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, I'm crestfallen because I was hoping that you could... You could take what has been 7 days and seven nights of me, my eyes peeling back as I keep connecting these dots and looking at all this information. So I won't burden you with my paper trail. Because, yeah,
sorry to disappoint
heart,
you. Probably will not be the last time during this call that I'm going to disappoint you.
That's okay. My heart just sank because I'm like, oh, there's my last hope to just settle this. I can sleep. For the most part, what happens, especially when something's political, and has a lot of layers to it. Even something as simple as like, is Allen Iverson going to retire? You know, things like that. When you see a story coming over the horizon, especially something that kind of pops up when it pops up and emerges, like a couple days ago, somebody hacked into somebody's account on the Jets and told a fan to drop dead. And it was like, you know, oh my God, something happened on Twitter. When you see these sort of news eruptions go on, From your vantage point, knowing the interconnectivity of all these different media, do you see this as being a sort of a growth stage that like the collective consciousness is like learning how to use these tools, or do you see it as there's a certain learning curve and some people are way ahead of it and some people will never get it and some people are just kind of in the middle sloshing around where we can be easily deceived now, where news is not so much news that's reported, it's sort of skewered, it's sort of aimed at different audiences, so the original story gets repackaged 8, 10, 15 different directions, and do you ever really know the truth?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, is that there's so many people that repackage this stuff, and there is a learning curve on the side of behavior standpoint, both on the listener and also on the person that's developing this news. I mean, that's what I consult a lot with businesses, and one very well is this guy at Ketchum, which is a large public relations firm. He was just happened to be down in Memphis, which is also the headquarters of where FedEx is headquartered, who's a client of Ketchum. And this guy doesn't even work on the FedEx account, but he posts a tweet that just says, I can't wait to get out of this dump of a town called Memphis. Thinks it's pretty innocuous, and all of a sudden his boss gets a note from the CEO of Federal Express saying, we don't appreciate you calling the town that we're headquartered in a dump. You know, we're a very big client of yours on down the line. So very intriguing from the standpoint of that guy doesn't even work on the account, but had very bad ramifications for his career just from a simple post that he put out there. I like the way you put the note on for listeners. I mean, definitely don't believe everything that you hear. That's not anything new. But it becomes even more complex in today's age because there's information's cheap, and your attention span is now the new currency. So your attention's the currency. So it's important to find those people that you do trust out there, and then those are the few folks that you follow.
Yeah, and again, this has become, like I said, this has become the new way of gaining access to information. It used to be you trusted Walter Cronkite, you trusted these you know mainstream media people. And I guess beginning with Dan Rather and so on down the line, it's like it used to be, and I remember this because I'm an old man. I'm almost 45. I remember when like sportscasters couldn't had to be like neutral. They couldn't root for different teams. Now they couldn't even talk about the spread on football games like I just did. Now they're basically in fantasy leagues, and it's like the fourth wall between what was supposed to be third person objective neutral reporting and this interactivity, this sort of subtext that goes on, which is more used to be relegated to columnists and op-ed pieces and things like that, has sort of been broken, and we have this sort of kind of gray that we're in now, where information or events or the way we relate to each other and communicate isn't completely ones and zeros, black and white anymore. It's sort of a landscape that's sort of alive. And, you know, Rushkoff calls it the data sphere. I mean, I've heard different names for it. But for the most part, it just seems like it's become to the point now where I can't tell if it's our little brains, you know, manipulating it, or we've humanized the technology to the point where it's a mirror of us, and it isn't an exact thing. You can't put a fork in the media anymore. It doesn't stay still.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, one thing, just thinking about TV that you jogged my memory on, is if you watch Fox News, you know you're going to get a Republican slant. If you watch MSNBC, you're going to get a Democratic slant. And then hopefully, if you watch CNN, you get somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, your bias is going to have you feeding a different side of the salad bar. And then,
exactly,
if you mirror that with your social network, who may have a mosaic of opinions, maybe by the conglomerate of that, you'll actually get the whole story.
Yeah, no, that's one of the reasons of the book that I state is that we're social animals by nature. And so with all this information out there, it's actually, some people say, well, I can't get on social media. I don't have time to do that. I don't even have time to live my life right now. How can I get on these social media tools? And what I like to say is, to kind of juxtaposition it, saying wasting time, quote unquote, on social media is actually productive, because what it allows for is all this information. It allows the people in your social graph that you trust to push the news your way, to push that. You no longer go out and search for the news, rather the news finds you. And so your social graph can go out and vet this information. And also the real exciting thing for businesses is that your social graph can go out, and if they've already figured out what the best child seat is to buy. I was sitting at dinner last night with a doctor, and he's like, I don't get all this social media hype. I mean, my wife's all on it 24/7, and I don't see any value in it. And I said, well, you've got a couple kids. You just purchased a child seat. You probably had no idea which child seat to purchase before you went into that, right? And he goes, yeah, you're right. And I go, that cost you a lot of time trying to figure out what the proper child seat was. You probably don't even know if you purchased the right one at the end of the day. But if your social graph, if you did that search, when you merge search and social media, if you do that search and it says that of your 150 friends, 10 have purchased a child seat in the last year, of those 10, 8 have purchased this exact make and model, and here's the reviews, they all rate it 5-star, that's a value to you, is it not? And he's like, oh yeah, now, okay, that makes sense. And so I say it's the elimination of multiple individual redundancies of people doing the same task over and over. Why do you have to do that if 10 people figured out the best hotel to stay in Bermuda?
Well, again, this is reversing that fourth wall again. Now, instead of getting pitched and sold and, you know, and sort of communicated where you know the person that's telling you stuff has an agenda when they're trying to sell you, it's like a travel agent used to do. Now you can go and actually canvas people that have been to Barbados or been to this hotel, that restaurant, whatever it is, and get the user feedback, which is like when you look at movie reviews or you go to Rotten Tomatoes or something like that, you pay much more attention to what the people say than what the critics say, because the critics have, like I said, they're almost tainted. They have that agenda. And the only ones you really want to listen to are the ones that have the same worldview as you anyway. So has it become to the point now where we've sort of like marketed ourselves or kind of like steered ourselves into these little niched islands where it's more difficult to get a variety of opinions, or people are just settled into, like, I feel like we just uploaded everything that goes on in high school, you know, all the cliques in high school and all the dynamics and all the jealousy and all the popular people are over here and the unpopular people are over there. It's like we've almost like reanimated high school in the digital era with social media. And you see how like MySpace acts much, much more like, you know, 9th and 10th grade, and Facebook acts much more like, you know, maybe 11th and 12th grade. So it's like there's a migration between, and every time one of these different platforms comes out, it seems to invite older users. Like one of the things I saw in your press clippings there is that the fastest growing market on Facebook is basically women in their 50s, reconnecting and things like that, and also interacting, like you say, about, you know, making better choices for as a consumer. So where do you see sort of the truth and sort of where the BS is when it comes to the social media? Has it entrenched itself so much into the old mainstays, like telephone and things like that, that we've gotten to the point now where it's sort of superseded that, where people are going to rely much more on things that they get from sources that are not, you know, coming from the media directly, but indirectly. I heard this on Fox, or I heard this on MSNBC from a friend. Like, you're not going to go to Katie Couric for stuff. You're not going to go to Matt Lauer for stuff. You're going to go from someone who watched the Today Show or saw this interview or saw this link. It seems like we live in a ping pong ball type of mentality, or sort of like a almost like a we're in a pinball machine in a way, where we're so sort of like it's almost like in order to participate in the culture, you have to kind of, you know, put yourself into this sort of maelstrom. Is kind of like almost like a windstorm of opinion, where fact and fiction are sort of like part and parcel. They're sort of like, you know, it's meat and potatoes. You got to take both of them. You got to be able to separate yourself. So how do you see this settling down? Are we at the point where we're getting to the strange attractor and we're going to get something out of the bottom of this thing, or it's still spinning for you?
I mean, some of the stuff is hype in terms of the amount of use. So most people that hop on, let's say, a Facebook, when they first get on it, they're going to spend a couple hours, maybe an hour or two a day, because they're just so entrenched, getting up to speed. They love it. They're diving in. But then over time, they realize, oh, I still have to do these other pieces of my life. So then it does come back a little bit. So you're going to see this come back. It's still going to be an integral part. It is an integral part of our lives, and that's not going away. But a lot of it, the media is grabbing hold of it because it's the sexy new toy right now. But it is going to a little bit, but it'll always be there. And it's not for everybody. Just like not everyone ran out and got rid of their landline telephone and just only use a wireless, yet a lot of people have done that. And so social media is not for everybody, but for the mass majority, it will be a part of their lives. And to your point about the high school, it's interesting because the choice to hear the different opinions outside of your network are always there. So you always have that option to go out and see what's being said outside. So that becomes a personal choice on if you want to go outside of your normal group. And then in terms of how this news is distributed, you're exactly right, is that it will be pushed. You no longer really go, unfortunately, it was very romantic to go to the end of the driveway and get that newspaper and have that coffee and sit down on Saturday morning. But more and more, most people just have the news pushed to them. They no longer go and look for the news. It's actually pushed to them. And a lot of times it's being pushed to them by their friends. Hey, check out this link. This is what's good, and this is what's interesting that's out there. And there's a lot of benefit to that. So if you think about Saturday Night Live, the way we always grew up, let's say, for argument's sake, it's a great show. But you have to sit through 90 minutes, 90 minutes of which probably may not be of interest to you. There might be 5 to 10 minutes of nuggets that you want to be interested in. You don't care about the band, possibly don't care about the commercials. And so you really, there's about 10 minutes of good content out of 90 minutes. So what happened during the 2008 election is that when they did the spoofs, Tina Fey of Sarah Palin, more people saw those spoofs and 5-minute clips being pushed around on YouTube than actually saw it on the show. And so that saved a ton of people all of that time. Instead of 90 minutes, now they have 5 minutes, and they got the 5 minutes that was good out of the show to watch it. So for society, it's actually a huge benefit because there's a lot more time that's going back into humans' lives, and hopefully they use that extra time for the greater good of society.
And again, we've gone from an era of, like with Seinfeld, must-see TV was the phrase back then 10 years ago, and now with Hulu and all these other things, basically we've reduced TV to highlights and clips like ESPN did a while ago, and we've sort of become a jump cut kind of culture, whether it's music or news or whatever it is, or political stuff like you're talking about, satire, or, like I said, movies, things that we're interested in. It's almost like we've become sort of, I don't want to say media critics, but we've definitely become to the point where we could take our palette of what we enjoy about the media and move it into our world and in and out of our world, same way we move things around on our desktop. We could move it around in terms of the way we experience it. The constants, the radio, the television, things like that, they've now become sort of like a little bit more fluid in the sense that other forms of radio, like this is the internet radio, you've got satellite radio, you've got HD radio, you've got a whole spectrum of different ways of getting audio out, whether it's MP3s or blogs or whatever. And it just seems to me that we've become a culture where everybody gets to be on both sides of the conversation, where sometimes we're the source and sometimes we're the audience. Do you see that settling down? Do you see that becoming much more stratified, or you see the line blurring even more as we go forward?
I see it blurring even more just because it's a competitive environment out there. And so a good example is that if you're listening, since you were talking about football right before this, I'm a huge football fan. I listen to a fantasy football podcast that's produced by ESPN. And so they've done some radical things from the standpoint of historically they had two or three reporters that would go out and be the experts and try to learn up on these teams. But then they realized that their audience could actually be their main competition at some point. So that if I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, and I've only known the Cleveland Browns since the age of two, and I've lived and breathed orange and brown, that that if I'm listening to that podcast and they're reporting on the Browns and they're kind of way off a little bit because that person's trying to become an expert on 12 to 15 teams, yet that's all I've followed all my entire life, that I might go out and start that podcast that's all about the Cleveland Browns. And so that's why ESPN, for a couple reasons, one, cost savings, also two, better content, but three, that they realize, hey, my audience could someday be my competition. They now have super fans and also bloggers locally to report on those teams. And so the content's generally better. I mean, you could argue sometimes it's not, but it's generally better because these people know everything about that team, and also they're diehard and passionate about it. And then also it keeps them, you know, the old saying is, right, if you can't beat them, join them. But they're kind of turning that on its head and trying to join them before they're beaten by their actual listeners. And you can call it the Tom Sawyer approach somewhat, because Tom Sawyer was very good at convincing his friends to help him paint the fence. Hey, this is exciting. Why don't you come paint the fence? And so they have these super fans and also bloggers that come in and actually enjoy it, do it for free to report on these other teams. So it's really intriguing what some of the companies are doing out there. And Facebook's also done this from a standpoint of, obviously, a lot of us know about Wikipedia, but you can use a wiki for really anything. And wiki is just a Hawaiian term that means quick. And so what Facebook did is that when they first started, they were only in English, and they realized, wow, there's a big demand for us in the Hispanic market. We should translate this to Spanish. Historically, what a company would do is that would take 1 to 2 years. It'd cost them millions of dollars and be a pain to do the translation, and it'd be a watered-down version of their original site. They just set up a wiki and said, hey, you, the user, can you please translate into Spanish? And what they saw was that it was done in a month with no cost to them to translate into Spanish. So there's really some intriguing things that are being done out there to take advantage of people wanting to contribute.
Yeah, I definitely see that happening. One of the things that you talk about a lot in the book is how we're repatterning behavior. And, you know, I said in the preview that, you know, you go from the mid-90s where you had a bunch of news wonks and, you know, cyberpunks on there, and the MUDs, if you remember the MUDs, you know, these things were very underground, very much the technical people were there. It wasn't the mainstream. And now you've got an era where the big carrot, it's like it used to be you went to L.A., you went to New York to try to get famous or whatever. Now you sit, I mean, Paris Hilton sitting there in the middle of nowhere in the flyover states, as they say, and he became a blog star. And then, you know, all these other people emerged in the last 5 or 6 years, and the categories kind of shifted. It's almost like watching the Piltdown Man in reverse. You have, like, the celebritards came up. There's the next wave where the Kardashian sisters and people like that, and they got reality shows. That became the next big cottage industry because you didn't have to pay the actors. You just point a camera, and you got a show. So from the mainstream standpoint, again, this is cutting costs. This is cheap. And we have an interactive, very loyal audience that's very into it. Shows like Survivor and Fear Factor came up into that. Then you had a lot of the YouTube sensations that came out, you know, Leave Britney Alone, people like that. And now you have this new era where I guess you're kind of on that panel of the social media experts. This stuff's only been around for 5 years, but we have about, I don't know, 20 or 30 people that have been, you know, flying under the radar, and now it popped up and become almost like the way, I guess, in the 60s, people were looking at television as a media that was affecting behavior because of advertising and things like that and the way they covered the Vietnam War. And then you see what goes on now in the sense of this, there's a shorter distance between anonymity and being a celebrity because of social media. You could become a Twitter star, you know, in a couple of weeks if you just spend every day and night, you know, putting yourself out there and engaging in different conversations, you cite Gary Vee. We had Gary Vee on the show a couple months ago, Gary Vaynerchuk, if you guys aren't familiar with Wine Library TV, and now he started a whole other company called VaynerMedia based on his social media prominence, and he was on Fox News this morning. The only reason I knew he was on Fox News was because I saw a commercial. It was, of course, he tweeted us at 7 o'clock in the morning, saying, hey, I'm getting up and driving from Jersey and going to the show, and, you know, flip it on at 7:30. And like a monkey I am, I went, oh, what the heck is he talking about? And he's sniffing his wine again. So it's like, you know, I can't believe, I catch myself going, oh, my God, there's no difference between what the old media used to do, which was coming attractions and teases and all the tricks of the trade, and what the social media expert does. Again, we've uploaded that from the old school before we had the internet and had social media tools like this and platforms like this. You'd have to go through so much in 2000 and say 3 or 4, and you didn't have these platforms, and you had to promote a television experience or something like that. So you'd have to email everyone you knew. You'd have to put stuff on your website or your blog and hope people found it. If they missed it, they missed it. Where now you tweet and it goes out to such a wide variety of things. Anyone that would go and search Twitter for Fox News or Fox and Friends in the morning that might not go to the Fox site, you're going to get 5 or 6 indirect ways of getting that message out. Well, before you only had 1 or 2 direct ways, and now you have this sort of spider web of way to kind of cast things out into almost like chum, you know, in the old fishing movies. You know, you throw the chum out there, and people show up. So this era of promoting yourself. And now the other thing that when they kind of tossed Web 2.0 over their shoulders is this era of personal branding. And I had Douglas Rushkoff on the show back in the spring when his book came out. I don't know if you're familiar with this Life Inc. book. Basically, his take on it is that we're not really operating from the standpoint of this open source era anymore. We've sort of adopted a corporatism where we're now taking all the elements of a corporation and we're putting it into our personal lives. We're branding ourselves and promoting ourselves like corporations did. And Gary Vee is a perfect example, and he is unabashed about this hustle and branding and this, and almost like Tom Peters would have been 20 years ago in his walking around management, thriving on chaos stuff, you know, when he was dealing with corporations that were starting to go into their little metamorphosis back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when the economy was going through a kind of a bend like now, and you had to make friends. So we're in an era now where Monster.com, you can get, my perfect example is my crazy brother-in-law, who pretty much gets a job every 18 months because he's a Bluetooth techie. He's gotten his jobs not by the old-fashioned way of submitting a resume, hiring a headhunter, going to a dozen interviews. No, he's always gotten his jobs through social media. He went on Facebook, I guess it was about a year ago now, and within 4 days, he got a job offer, flew to New York, got the job, moved his family. You know, how does that, I mean, those things that happen that quickly, where they used to take, you know, any number of months sometimes to happen, even selling your house, whatever it is, now can take literally a tenth of the time. Is all that speed healthy for us? Are we going to get to the point where we get so impatient if it takes 2 weeks to do something? Are we becoming sort of an ADD culture where it has to happen instantaneously? We don't understand process. All we understand is click, result. And that's why when things don't change quickly on our offline lives, it bleeds into like a lot of the things we see behaviorally, because you do talk about how the web affects behavior. We'll get into that in a minute. But how do you feel all this speed is affecting us in terms of the way we communicate and the way that we function on a daily basis?
As a net, it's good, but there's always downside to everything. And so Gary's awesome because from his standpoint, how has he been successful to even say this? I mean, he'll come out there and go, okay, you know, I'm not going to talk till I'm blue in the face for companies that won't embrace social media. He's like, good companies understand it, will embrace it, and they'll win. And bad companies that fold their arms and think it's stupid, they're going to lose. And Gary does a great job from a standpoint of his personal brand by, you think it's, one, he's a good seller, but every good seller is a great listener. So if you actually see the amount of work that he puts in to make sure he tries to have that personal touch with so many people out on the web that comment and support him, then he'll say it's a lot of work, but in the end, it's a good payoff. But the pros and cons of some of this stuff in terms of the speed is that you're starting to see from the Generation Y, they struggle a little bit with interpersonal communication, especially when they get in the workforce, because they're used to dealing in 140 characters, texting, and really not face-to-face conversation. So that is one of the downsides, is that they have a much bigger learning curve to try to figure out how to have those normal conversations face-to-face. But the one upside is that they're very, very good at getting to the point of an issue, to really getting to the core and essence of something. And so I think it might have been Mark Twain, but I'm not sure who said it. But, you know, I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one, because it takes a little more effort to actually get to the essence of something. But in the end, all this stuff, speed, information, the customer is going to win, because the good companies and products are going to win, because it's no longer dependent on who has the largest marketing budgets. It's no longer dependent on who controls the middleman, whether that's a political party. If you look at the Obama versus Hillary, it's really Obama versus Hillary in that situation. As Obama wins, even though Hillary controlled the Democratic Party at that point, she controlled that middleman or that mechanism. So historically, it would have been almost impossible for Obama to win. But what did he do? He leveraged a lot of things, one of which was social media to not only raise money, but also have that grassroots effect to come about. So there's a lot of great things about social media that net positive. But obviously, there are some other downsides. And I talked a little bit about the book, is that you do have to live your life as if your mother's watching you, because there's so much transparency. And one kind of catchphrase I use is, what happens in Vegas stays on YouTube. And so as a society net, that's great. That's better. But yeah, there's some downside, because who knows how many people just don't have that release anymore, where they can kind of be that party animal on the weekend and no one's going to know about it, and they're a buttoned-up accountant during the week. So talk a little bit about in that book. There is some downside to some of the stuff, but as a whole, it's a net positive.
Yeah, and again, going back 10 years ago, you know, when you discuss the issue was security back then, you know, Y2K, things like that, and now it's much more about trust. It's much more about openness, where you can open up and have these things done. And we've moved from an era of Big Brother, you know, where we're feeling like, you know, and again, we're still in the era where, you know, they're eavesdropping on emails, and they're monitoring the web, and they transcribe this show, and they, you know, all kinds of things go on that now I'm aware of, and my eyes are opening up in the back of my head in the last week with this Ukrainian thing. But you hit the nail on the head. We're moving into an era where the social media is becoming a surrogate digital big mother, where it's nurturing us in the sense that it's giving us sort of a digital playground to interact and maintain contact with everybody, where a kid that goes away to school could still talk to their high school buddies or whatever, you know, 24/7 on, you know, as they sit there and interact during the day, you know, with all the tools that they can possibly carry around with them. But the other part of it is, like you said, now because of the self-promotion side, you talk about braggadocian behavior that comes up, where if somebody does that too much, it almost works against them, where the old media was all about, you know, tooting your own horn. And, you know, like Seth Godin and some of the other guys talk about now, this, the idea of permission marketing, where people opt in. Are we moving to an era now, because there's so much out there, and I had this discussion last week a little bit, where content used to be something that was valuable, now is something that is sort of the chum again, to get someone to participate, to engage with you. You have to give up so much for free in terms of your proprietary information, your opinion, your expertise, whatever it is. And then you see how that's affecting things like search. And I want to get into that a little bit with you, because the era of the search engine, as you said at the top of the show, is sort of fading, where we don't trust what Google gives us. Google isn't efficient. Google is just a big database, and it has a lot of layers, and there's a lot of ways to sit there and cross-reference. I used to dogpile all the time. I used to dogpile when I'm an old man. And now you could go and just tweet something to your Twitter crowd or search Twitter and get information much quicker and much more accurately, because it's more granular. So, you know, kind of like moving through this from A to B, have we gotten to the point where open source, free information that has expertise behind it, opinion-based information that's like, you know, getting something from WebMD or something like that, where that stuff's going to become, you know, as the newspapers are starting to do, you pay in to get that stuff. And the other part of it is that the people that are still using the old tools of sort of interruption marketing, where they're just going to shout everybody, is that starting to become regulated by the web's new level of netiquette of no, you don't do that. You come in and sit by the campfire and share your story. You don't sell us. You just tell us. Do you see those things emerging in the last maybe 2 or 3 years where the behaviors are shifting?
Yeah, definitely it's shifting radically. And the CMO of Ford, Jim Farley, states it's no longer us telling it. We have to have the people that use our products tell the story. And so it's interesting from their standpoint is they've shifted their dollars. Historically, less than 10% of dollars go towards online digital media. And they've shifted it to where 25% is focused on digital/online media. And ironically, they're the only U.S. automaker that hasn't taken a loan. They're the healthiest because they're starting to – they really embrace social media with a lot of the work that Scott Monty's doing. And getting to your question about content, I think Gary probably spoke about this on your show when he was on, is that he doesn't make a sale – he doesn't make a dime from producing his 7 to 10 minute videos about wine. It's after the fact when he rolls up his sleeves and people are engaged through that free content he supplies that he makes that sale. So he has to give away a lot of that content for free, knowing that at the end is where he's going to make his money. And it's the irony of what I'm doing is I'm selling books. So we have to use social media to sell the book, Socialnomics. And so if I produce a video, Social Media Revolution, first I go out and listen. What are the pain points that are people having out there? And the pain point people were having is a couple months ago was, what is social media? Why is it, you know, why do I care? Isn't this just a kid's thing? And so that's why I listen and go, wow, a lot of people are struggling with this. So why don't I put together a 4-minute video with just a bunch of statistics to music so that people can really see it that way instead of having to try to explain it for hours on end. Let's just put a video together for 4 minutes that helps explain it with some data. And so I produced this video, and what's the first thing that my publisher says is, well, you didn't really put the image of the book in the video, or you didn't put a lot of mentions of the book in the video. What are you doing? And I go, well, no, I'm trying to meet the need of the user, not my need. And in the end, this will sell more for everybody, and it's really the benefit for everyone. I'm not just using this to sell. I'm using this to provide content that's worthwhile to people that might use it. So that's why the video, fortunate, and there's a lot of luck involved, has had 1.3 million views. But then from there, then I go out and make sure on the web that if someone's mentioning the video, I'll say, I'm glad you really liked the video. You might enjoy some of the content in my book. And so it's really just trying to provide that value add. So there's no sale from that original video. It's just I'm down the line trying to help people out to see if they find any value in the book itself.
And again, this is something that publishing houses, because the bookstores are closing, just like the newspapers are going down, are starting to understand that maybe the best way to promote, you know, a new book and a book that doesn't have an author name recognition, that just has good information in it. You know, I'm not going to say that you're not going to rub shoulders with Tom Clancy one day, but you know, your circle might know you, but the mainstream probably would never heard of you. And something the move you made by making that video and getting, you know, over 1 million people, it's another thing that Gary talks about. He goes, you know, the mainstream will always go where the eyeballs are, and if you're attracting an audience like this, they'll approach you, they'll come find you. And so we have almost like the tail and the dog are reversing here, where we used to be so bombarded by the mainstream media and by the traditional approaches that, you know, between all the ads, remember when banner ads were on the side of the road? Now they're coming up all over, you know. So it's like, again, another one of these things where we've kind of digitized that. And now the mainstream is more of a feedback system. It's more of a monitoring system. It weights the news. It doesn't so much report it. It sort of weights the story based on audience activity, not so much on newsworthiness. So that's why the era of gossip and all the things that we talk about offline has become cottage industry online, and we've made things that were frivolous into things that have a lot of monetary value, where before they never would. All those channels on cable that no one ever watched, you know, the cooking channels and the travel channels, now they have an audience online that makes those channels more valuable to the cable operator. And as things go forward and those episodes and those things become content online, become content on Hulu, and get to the telephones and things like that. I remember it was such a buzz the first time I took JetBlue and they had a TV on the back of the seat, you know? It was like, there's my TV. It was like, it's becoming the cultural pacifier to constantly have something to interact with that's not local to you. And a couple of days ago, I just updated my Skype account, and they completely redecorated the format on Skype, where now basically you are Captain Freaking Kirk on Skype. You could talk to just about anybody and anything in four or five different modes at the same time, and not your brain doesn't turn to oatmeal. Where before, you open up two things on Skype at the same time, you thought you were going to burn out like the half the Eastern Seaboard because Skype was kind of rudimentary. So I guess because you're looking at it as age brackets, we've become generationless in the sense that everybody needs to have a phone, everybody needs to communicate. So that part's taken care of. The content part, like I said before, you know, as a doctor, I got information that's proprietary. Someone asked me about, you know, this morning I was waiting outside to put my kid on the bus. One of the tenants walked by, and I was standing there waiting for my kid to come down the hill, started talking to me about their rotator cuff. And, you know, they're not going to ask me if I'm an electrician. They ask me because I'm a doctor. So it's almost like everybody's become everybody else's search engine. And we've made it so that I think, and maybe you can verify this from your research, have we made each other more approachable offline because we meet online first? It used to be just the dating community did that, and now we're doing it in business. Now we're doing it in all types, like you talked about before, with, you know, buying things like the baby stroller, things like that. Have we become much more, have we removed the stranger layer? We've become acquaintances online, so when we meet, we're almost on the threshold of becoming friends because we found common ground online, and then when we meet, it's like things like Meetup, you have a group interest already preset. So it's almost like encouraging us to be more socially interactive offline. I don't know if that's happened yet.
I think it's happening. It's starting to happen more and more. And it's funny because there's really, in my mind, the blind date's gone away, which there's some sadness to that, right? It's, you can see what the person looks like, what's their areas of interest, because more and more, is Match.com more valuable to me or is Facebook more valuable to me if I know this person knows my friend? You know, if I know this quote-unquote blind date also knows someone in my network and they can vouch for them, it's a little better experience. But again, that blind date somewhat goes away. But a lot of the mundane conversation that we've historically had to where if you were to catch up with someone, the first 15 minutes is kind of somewhat mundane. Here's what I'm doing, and it's a lot better now because you're up to speed on what they're doing. You probably know where they work, where they live, based on the information in social media. If you're following some of their status updates, you kind of know a little of the nuances that they have two kids, what's going on with them, so that when you do have that conversation face-to-face, if it's with someone you know, you can jump right into the heart of the matter and have a little more deeper conversation. And also, too, if it's someone you haven't met face-to-face, if you go to a Mashable tweet-up, for instance, then you share a common interest and you sort of know this person before you even show up. And this is going to happen when I go to Chicago. I'm having conversations with folks that are be at this event that they're hosting where I'm going to be there. And so I'm having these conversations before I get there. So it's not a complete room of strangers. There's people that I've interacted with online. So I think it's already starting to happen, and I actually think it's a big benefit.
Well, in the short run, I think it is. I think, like I said, I remember like meeting my college roommate, basically standing in line to get my key, up in Albany in the early '80s, and now, you over the summer, once you know who your roommates are going to be, college students basically are becoming pen pals before they even meet, and they're removing a lot of the barriers, a lot of the self-conscious part, a lot of the small talk, and I think what you're suggesting is that we're getting more into a culture of brevity, a culture of much more targeted conversation where there's not a lot of filler, there's not a lot of phoniness, there's not a lot of, you know, formality to it. And that's why a Gary V can wave it at his flip cam and pull in new wine drinkers that were previously sort of excommunicated from being even going into a wine store because they felt like that's not for me. It's only for these elite people that know about wine. And he's taken that stigma away. the same things happen with fitness. The same things happen with fashion. A lot of these areas where it was only for certain people now has become part of the culture, of almost like a spectrum of involvement where it's proportionate to your interests rather than proportionate to how much they bombard you from the advertising side. So taking a left turn into search, because that's one of the areas that you cover in the book a lot, is the evolution of search engines and the evolution of how we interact with them and how they have meaning in our lives. And as Google's become sort of the mother ship, like an Independence Day that's kind of parked over us all the time, and all the other search engines have become, I don't want to say lesser than, but Yahoo compared to Google now is sort of like Jack in the Box compared to McDonald's. You know, it's just one of those things over there. It doesn't really have the same pull as it used to. What do you see as the sort of logical endpoint of Google as a sort of the second generation Microsoft? It's like it's so omnipresent, it's so everywhere, that will it become, you know, sort of like Microsoft, where should we just assume it's everywhere and we don't care? Because, or do you see it becoming like AOL, where at a certain point we're gonna cut bait with it and say, you're over there, but we're over here now? Because it seems to gobble up everything. I call it gobble instead of Google at the time.
I like the gobble. I also like the slight to Jack in the Box. He's probably sitting there going, wait, what did we do?
Oh, yeah, Jack in the Box. You know what? The cards and letters, I'll sift through it later because it takes me about half an hour to sift through my feedback after the show because I piss off just about everybody, but whatever. But I'm giving a proportion. It's almost like I said, the amount of audience that a search engine used to have was proportionate before to its capacity to give you relevant information. Google, because of the way it was designed, especially with Gmail, once Gmail came in and email has gone away, and a lot, like you talk about a lot of people don't even, in generation, I guess, Y and Z at this point, I guess I'm at the end of the beginning of X and the end of the boomer, and it's all the lines are blurred. They don't even use email. Email to them is inefficient. And because the texting is faster and other things are faster, they only use email for very, very formal, very, you know, official things. When Gmail came in and it gave you unlimited capacity, it was web-based, it wasn't going to be hacked in your computer, all those things that Gmail made special, that to me was when Google became this, you know, uber monster, not just a search engine, but it became a multifunctional platform. Now, you've probably, because you're in the technical world up to your eyeballs, you've probably taken your little test drive through the Google Wave, have you?
Yes.
Okay. Now, do you see this monster working? Because it to me, it is the snuffleupagus of digital technorati.
It'll be interesting. I mean, my take on it, and I've been wrong before, but this is, at least I'll put an opinion out there, is that having tested Google Wave, the one thing that Facebook's great at, and that's why they've got so many, over 300 million users, and they're getting the moms and the grandmas to come up there, is they keep it simple. And Google Wave, in my mind, it's supposed to be, for those that don't know, it's really supposed to be the 21st century version of email. So it's Google's answer to status updates and tweets, trying to combine it all together to where a normal conversation flows. So Generation Y and Z do see email as passe because they see it almost as like a CD where it's, I'm having a good time, out, are you having a good time? Whereas the tools like Facebook, you can have multiple people in a conversation just like you would in real life. But my take on Google Wave is it might be too bleeding edge. It might be ahead of its time. It might be too complicated for the general masses. And you need that adoption to take place by the masses in order for it to be successful. And the Google things, I love that you use gobble, especially around Thanksgiving. I love that tie-in. But the fun thing about Google is that you do have to be kind of cautious. I love those guys to death. I was just out there a couple weeks ago. And their whole thing is do no evil. But once you become a publicly traded company, which they've been for several years, is that you don't have that same control as you once did. And so a lot of times it does go towards the bottom line. And you can see it on the search side that, bless their hearts, they haven't been pushed by anyone to advance the search. So there's no inherent reason for them to go out and try to fix something that they think is not broken, since no one's really screaming that this stuff's broken. And except for people like me, that I'm sitting here going, we're going to look back and laugh at how archaic these search results are. Why am I getting the same results as Dr. Mark for Paris Hilton? So I might be searching for the actress, and Mark really wants to know, I want a hotel in Paris. And so why does everyone get the same search results? And also, too, is if I'm searching for a child seat or a hotel in Bermuda, an algorithm is really not that helpful for me. It's somewhat helpful. But what's more helpful is really people being able to say, actually, this is the best hotel, and pulling in that data from a TripAdvisor. But it's different because the data from TripAdvisor will also show, here's five of your friends, here's their ratings. So here's all the 130 ratings in TripAdvisor, but here's five that came from your friends for that specific location that you're looking for. And so that's really where you're going to see search and social come in. And Google really understands that. They understand their competition's not Yahoo, MSN, Bing, or whatever the latest search tool is. Their competition is really these social media players, Twitter and Facebook. And so they've launched tools like Google Wave. They've also launched a tool called Google SideWiki. This enables any website that you go to, if you have the Google toolbar, on the left side will be a pane that opens up that has all user comments about that site. So those comments might be like, this is the best product ever, make sure you use it. Or it could be, this product sucks, and here's a video showcasing why it sucks. So the control of the company, of their brand, is becoming less and less, and that's why good companies will win. Good companies that actually react to what customers want are going to win, because there's tools like a Google SideWiki that are going to come into play. It's called, other people call it layering, but there's tools like that that are coming out. There's also Google's Hot Trend, which is really a reaction to Twitter that shows, here's the top trending items on Twitter. Is it on Google? They've got Hot Trends now. Here's the top trending searches that are happening. So, and a lot of this stuff's not new. It's just, it becomes news when Google does it. So there is definitely in the back of your head, you got to be careful that Google does become this next Microsoft, because then that advancement slows down. But I think that one thing that really excites me about these social media players like a Facebook is that they're kind of pushing it out there. And it looks like they're going to try to kind of take on the big boys, because Mark Zuckerberg, the Uber, the wonder kid that started Facebook, could have taken billions of dollars months ago and years ago, but he's decided he wants to be probably the next Bill Gates or whoever it is, whatever that luminary you want to put out there, because he wants to advance society, it looks like, and we'll see what happens.
So we can say goodbye to what's his name from MySpace, who's everybody's friend. I forget
Tom?
His name already. Yeah, Tom.
Tom can join.
Yeah. You
know. Yeah.
He can start singing with the choir. He's jumped the shark in terms of what we're talking about here. This is one of those things, and maybe you can explain it to me from, you know, inside the book out. You talk about the glass house generation. Is that everybody, or is that just people that are, like, my kids were born 1995, 1996. Internet was just starting to come in. They don't know life without the Internet. I was born in the 60s, so I remember black and white TV. So it's like when cable came in, it was like Star Trek to me. So what we have now with all these platforms, like you're talking about, emerging, and they're mobile and they're wireless and all these words that make me nuts. When you're talking about a glass house generation, are you talking about the fact that everything we do in our offline lives now has an online mirror, a reflection, a record? One of the things that Gary talks about in his book that he uses as a moral compass is that he realizes his grandchildren are going to be able to watch him on YouTube, watch his life unfold, and see his activity. So if he's not doing things, if he's not productive, and there's a big gap in the record, what were you doing back then, Grandpa? So it's almost like a digital accountability that almost borders on fanaticism in a way, where we're so focused on being visible, we're so focused on being in touch with everybody, that I don't know if our offline lives really have an independence from it anymore, because the shadow's always there. Like you said, the mom's always watching. So I'm just, you know, there's a lot of things I did between the ages of 15 and 25 that I'm glad there's no record of. I am glad it is in somebody's brain cells that were long since destroyed. I see this almost becoming sort of like a mindset where, like you said before, that, yeah, the speed's there, the efficiency there. I put that dopey SideWiki on for 5 minutes before because I knew I was coming to the show. This thing's a pain in the neck. It moves everything over about 2 inches on the screen, and now I got to read 50 freaking videos for everything I search for. I said, get out of this side, Wiki. I'm an old man. I can't cope with that many things invading my eye space to get something done. It seems like we've made efficiency into an industry instead of into an actual verbal or you know, a physical action. And I don't know where I would end. So explain the glass house generation to the listeners.
Yeah, you nailed it right out. I mean, you nailed it. It's essentially the generation of why all of us are now have to live in a world of transparency. But obviously, we're labeled Generation X. There's a baby boomer generation. There's the silent generation ahead of that. Is
right.
That this generation's growing up in a world to where everything they do has that record, to use Gary Vee's word. And part of it is fantastic because if I'm updating my status, so I'm in line at the grocery store, and I forgot the stats, but I think you spend 10% of your life in line. So you whip out your smart. What is it?
I think you're right, 10%.
Yeah, I think it's 10% you're waiting around. So now you're productive because you'll get on there and you'll update your status. You'll read what your friends are doing. But if you update your status, then I'm watching reruns of Saved by the Bell or Gilligan's Island or Three's Company. That's not very exciting. And so it gives you a real-time assessment of your life so that you don't 10 years from now look back and go, what did I do with my life? Like, what was I doing? What did I contribute to society? Or what did I contribute? What did I build? What did I make? And so Gary's right on from the standpoint of you're getting that real-time assessment of what you're doing. Where we have the misfortune, Generation Xers, is that we kind of span that gap. So there is stuff we did 15 to 25 that unfortunately there are pictures, and you just keep your fingers crossed that no one's going to scan those in as a PDF and put them up in social media. So
yeah.
So that's like every day you probably wake up and go, oh, God, I hope that one photo's not up there.
Well, it seems like my elementary school is coming back to me slowly as people dig through their closets and upload these pictures of everybody in kindergarten and stuff. And I go, oh, okay, that's fine. As long as it stops around second or third grade, then we're good. You know, because it's like there's a lot of stuff I want to leave in Franklin Square and I never want to see it again. So it's I guess, you know, again, approaching the holidays, this is another thing that because of the fact that, and maybe you have some stats on this, since the swine flu campaign, I'll call it, began back in the spring when everything was going on everywhere else but the United States, and it slowly kind of crept across like a big eclipse, and now we're in this era now where they're gonna go through their second generation of, oh, we've got to scare them again around the holidays. And I saw it this morning, and they were showing like, this is perfect. And again, this is the invasionary kind of property of the social media where we can't leave people at peace. They on Fox News, they went down the aisle of a plane taking off in Newark. People sitting there exhausted at 7 o'clock in the morning. They're going to travel all day, wherever they're going. And everybody that's sitting on the plane getting ready to take off has their cell phones up showing the camera that they're on Fox News. So, you know, it's like, and it's like, everyone's ready for the trip. And it's like, you know, and then what do you do? What they wanted to discuss with people, what do you do if somebody next to you sneezes? And who's going to answer that question honestly with the entire universe watching them? You know, it seems like we're putting people in this, like, almost like this big game show that sort of has no beginning and no end and no prizes, just a whole bunch of contestants. In a treasure hunt back in the 70s, you know, which box is the prize in? I just don't know what the value of that much sort of interactivity has when there's no subjectivity. There's almost this uber objectivity where everything's observed, everything is sort of connected to everything else, and we don't get to really get to a point where we can reflect and make an honest judgment. The answer I always tell people with my clients, because they live at the tip of, you know, they work at the tip of Manhattan there in the financial district, a lot of them, and the other ones on the Upper West Side, the artists, you know that like are Luddites about it. I said, you know, the best answer when you don't know is, I don't know. And people try to fill in that blank with something, like I said, do something productive. No, I'm standing in line. This is all I'm going to do right now. I just see this social stigma to just hyperactivity to the point where people are not conditioned to recover from everything they've done. When does the day end? I forget the guy I had on last year, talking about how many people check email every couple of minutes. Tim Ferriss, about how he has like a no email policy. You know, he puts out a thing and says, look, I don't return email. Every 2 weeks I check it. What? How do you do that? People check it every 14 seconds. People are checking it 63% of the time. There's an interruption in a day in a meeting. All these stats came out about how much time people are spending checking all these filters. You know, I get up in the morning, I used to just check one email. Now I got to check my business email, my private email, my old archived emails from when I only had a couple of things going on over here, and then you've got to go to Facebook and you got to go to Twitter. It takes you 10, 15 minutes. I used to go to the mailbox. I used to check email the day started. Check my voicemail. And now it's become this sort of like, you know, sweep through all these appliances to see where the activity is. And there's other things that have come out that kind of dovetail, like a ping, and there's other ones that will just send the message out to everything all at once. Are we getting to the point where we're going to stop producing these platforms and we're okay? Or you think we're going to keep trying to, you know, niche out every little kind of pixel out there so that, you know, the music goes this way and the videos go that way and my opinions about politics go that way? Or are we going to just basically be able to throw it all at one wall at a certain point?
The hope is, it looks like it. Sorry, go ahead.
I said, or you could say, I don't know.
Like I did at the beginning of the show when you stopped me with the plague in the Ukraine.
Yeah, that was perfect. I was glad you said it because, believe me, if you'd have flopped, I would have swamped out on you like a locust because I've been reading this stuff like to the point now where I have no eye left. It's just a giant pulsing brain reading all this garbage. Because people, it's like, I'll give you this because this, you know, this is something that maybe you could kind of like follow up with me. I gave people this list at the beginning of the show, and it's like if I told you there was 6,000 people dead in 9 regions around the Ukraine right now, they're dead. The WHO is only willing to admit about 300 or so, and there's been absolutely no news activity in those areas. The people that live in those regions have been quarantined. The hospitals have hundreds of thousands of people bombarding them, and they're still trying to get out a press release to say, is it a strain of H1N1, or is it a bioweapon? So the two choices are, it's a mutated, you know, version of the old flu that's killing people, or there's some type of bioterror going on in the Ukraine that's spreading over from Afghanistan and Western China. Neither one of those messages, you know, make you get your stuffing down any easier tomorrow. But you know, inquiry minds might like to know. We're maybe less interested in that than we are with what Adam Lambert tried to pull off the other night. But, you know, be that as it may, if you take that dot as one dot in the whole neural network here, and you pump in things like I gave before, climate gate, which is the I don't know if you're aware of this one. They hacked into the scientific website that had all the stuff about the global warming scientists that basically said they cooked all their data. It's called ClimateGate. So it's like they cooked all their data because there was a big agenda that ties into this big Copenhagen summit that talks about global warming as a political thing to make things go international, kind of vis-a-vis the way GATT treaty and everything that happened back to open up the free trade routes, to basically make things more international so that we move towards a world currency and then all the people with the tinfoil heads come out with all their conspiracy theories. In between that, you've got a very, very real thing. A company called Verichip bought a company called Steel Vault. You know what Steel Vault makes? Those little chips that go in your body. So, and Massachusetts, the great state of Massachusetts you're in, is one of the first states that said, you know, we're going to start putting chips in people's body to see who got the flu vaccine and who didn't. They're trying to fast-track that law. And then you read something like Agenda 21. I didn't know what Agenda 21 is until about 3 o'clock this morning. It's this big 40-chapter document that the UN came out with about 30 years ago that talks about what we're going to do in the 21st century in terms of the way we're going to connect all these governments. So you have 6,000 people dead in the Ukraine and all these things circulating around it, and no major news media is reporting any of it. You can't find it on CNN. You can't find it on any of these major sites. You put in pneumonic flu in any one of these major sites, MSNBC, anyone, nothing. The only ones that have anything are YouTube, and what's happening is private citizens that live in Europe are making these little flip cam videos, little Gary Vee videos. Hello, I'm in the Ukraine, help! And YouTube is pulling them off. It says video no longer available, not because of copyright infringement, but because they look at it as alarmist information. So there's a filter. So now Big Mother is now becoming a little bit like Big Brother, like saying, we don't want to panic you. So do you see that the open source era and the era of interactivity reaching a threshold where a hoax like what happened out in Colorado a couple months ago with the balloon thing was something that an Orson Wellian type of an event where we think something's happening when maybe it's not, and it's just a big scam, a big scopes thing, and everyone's running to the smoking gun to see if it's real, that if you see something that because we live in this, and you talk about reality media coming out of reality TV, we're going to have reality shows based on what's happening in social media. Do you see the line blurring so much that the fourth wall that we broke down a while ago, now we want to put that wall back up and say this is only a movie, this is only, you know, like what happened in War of the Worlds. Do you see we could start things that we can't stop because we're right on the cusp between complexity and chaos here, where if it spills over, you know, those people living in the hills in West Virginia with their militias, they're ready to roll. So it's like, you know, but how do you see us containing all of this? I don't want to call it news, just a lot of just data being an opinion being uploaded to the point where the popcorn pop bubbles over. Do you think that that's even possible? And what do you make of what I just said about all those dots I just put out there? If you're sitting here and you're being the objective social media expert you are, how do you even investigate something like that?
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is very complex, but it's funny that, not funny, but on some of these pieces is that the information moves so fast. So if you look at the flu, historically, they'd figure out where the flu was spreading by determining the CDC, how many orders are coming in from the vaccine. CDC report, okay, they're coming in from these regions. This is where it is. To where now you can utilize technology out there to figure out if there's this amount of searches or this amount of tweets coming from these areas. It's not 100% fail-safe, but it gives you a better sense of, okay, here's where the trends are kind of happening. And you can use that whether it's for the flu, or you could see that during the presidential race between Hillary and Obama, that if you looked at Indiana, you saw that the searches for Obama were indexing through the roof. And so even though Hillary won that state, she barely won it, and it wasn't as the predictors, as wide a margin as the prediction thought it was. And if they would have looked at that search data, they would have known it was going to be a little bit tighter. So some of this stuff we can utilize for the betterment of society. And to your point, whether it's Bubble Boy or anything that's being reported out there, is the ironic thing is if you look back, let's say 5 years ago, is that people said, well, these are blogs, this is blog radio, these are bloggers, you can't trust this stuff. You got to trust the national media. They're the best source for anything that's really factually correct. And what's happened to the national media is they're under a lot of pressure because now there are all these blogs that report stuff very quick in real time. And so they might not vet it out as much. They're trying to get ratings so that they can still get the old advertising model, their dollars, so that they have the right amount of eyeballs, because they're being attacked from all these media outlets that are attracting eyeballs. And so that's what you see out there, is that a lot of the national media is kind of stretching to either get the story out quick or get out the sensational story. And so, I mean, I lived in Miami for a while, and after a while you realize that, okay, there really isn't a threat of a hurricane, but the reason they're on the news all the time is because that attracts viewers, that they're talking about a potential hurricane that's coming. So there's a fine line between, that's where they're trying to go after the almighty dollar, and unfortunately it puts a little bit more of the burden on the customer and the user to understand what's really factually correct and what's not. And that's where you do become back reliant on your friends, so that if a couple of them have fact-checked it or dug in a little deeper, then you can rely on them. And it's funny, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but more and more folks, I couldn't imagine being a doctor in this day and age, because there's so much information out there, whether it's WebMD or just information that's coming from your friends that's being pushed your way, is that more and more people actually trust their friend that has the same affliction that they do on how they treated it, rather than their doctor. You know, they get all this information right before they go into their doctor, and then they come in there rooted for bear.
Well, the drug companies figured this out a while ago, where they just tell you the new drug, and you walk in like a drug rep and ask your doctor for the drug. They give you, if you have a prostate problem, Flomax is coming out of every orifice in the culture, and they're running to the urologist waving their Flomax papers. I want my Flomax. So they created demand based on not supply or real need, but based on the fact that they can capture enough people that are suffering with given condition X, and they could find given condition X by using the same tools that the layperson would use to find the drug. So it's like we're crossing the streams here. Like the interesting thing you said about how you would sort of, you know, vet these rumors and stories by going on an index thing like that. Now just for the listener's sake, because everyone kind of cheats in the show and listen to the last 10 minutes because this is where the juice comes out. What do you, when you get, I'm telling you, we've been squeezing the orange here for about an hour. When you get something like this on your plate, like Ukrainian, the demonic, the plague, okay, is it real? Where do you go first? Are you going to go to your social network and say, WTF, and then put the link, and go, what is this? Or are you going to go do something like you just said, where you're going to index it? And what was the thing you said that will tell you where the sources are coming from? Because that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go in and look at searches, if there's a couple tools out there that allow you to do that in Google Labs, and they're free to the public. You can go in and just look to see where the searches are occurring, whether it's in the United States or the world. So you could go in and do a search for whatever term it is, let's just call it swine flu, and see that, oh, okay, all of a sudden it's indexing high in Tanzania. Those searches are indexing high there. So anything you want to see where people are really searching to try to find stuff, you can go into Google Labs and do that. And also, obviously, Twitter's a great source. You can just go in and put in the search bar. You used to have to go to search.twitter.com, but now they have it on the homepage. You can just type in whatever term you want, and then you can see everything that's kind of be set out there about it with the proper links to different stories so that you can, if you want, go in and read the 15 different viewpoints and then make the assessment on what you think's true and what's not true. And within that course, there might be a couple luminaries that you're looking to where it's like, oh, Dr. Mark's the expert on that. I'm just going to go straight to him and figure out what he's saying about it because I trust his judgment. Or you might have three people that you trust on a certain subject. And that kind of gets back to what you're talking about with owning your own personal brand.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about the plague in the Ukraine because it's not in my wheelhouse. So that's one thing that more and more people need to become better at, is figuring out what is your sweet spot and really trying to hammer that home. And in Marcus Buckingham's book, Discover Your Strengths, he talks about how China is very good at this because there's billions of people in China, right? So they have to really focus on what they're going to be good at from an early age. And so they're a lot better at it than us as Americans historically. But more and more, you have to really figure out what's your wheelhouse. So for Gary Vee, he knows it's all about really wine and social media. And so anything outside that, he's probably not going to spend too much time on. So if you ask him right, who's in the Jets, right? But if you ask him who's starring in XYZ movie, or you ask me, I'll go, I have no idea. You know,
I don't know. Like I said, that's the best answer. I don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, but like I said, because of the game show mentality of this, people feel this peer pressure to find out, to know everything about everything. When we live in a niched out world where you're much more of a utility to people when you are an expert, when you are the source for a certain like bandwidth of information, and when something doesn't fall in your strike zone, either you go, I don't know, or you go, ask Bill, you know, over here.
Right.
And you could direct people to someone else in your network. You know, because it happens to me, you know, it's almost like I was raised a Catholic and became a chiropractor, but I outgrew both of them. So it's like, you know, so now I'm into somatics. Now, somatics is like the tofu of the bodywork community because it touches every discipline, psychology, developmental stuff, brain science. So it is a potpourri. So I'll get questions from not only left field, but from deep in the bleacher seats about, you know, stuff like the freaking, you know, plague. And it's like, you know, especially when H1N1 came out, it's like, so you're giving people information that not necessarily is, and I always couch it like this. I said, I'll give you information that's either actionable or referenceable. If I give you referenceable information, I'm directing you to the source that I got it from. You go talk to them. If it's actionable, now we have a conversation. We go back and forth. And making that distinction with people, especially when something is, like I say, not in your wheelhouse, is another layer of sort of intelligence with this meeting, where we have to realize we're the ones driving this technology. And the more we humanize the conversation within it and become – unmasked in a sense, and not try to perform to some kind of like artificial standard and be the Shell answer man for everything. You become much more of a reliable person to interact with, rather than someone who always has, you know, kind of a riff on something just to have a riff, just to stay in the conversation. It's not like we're batting a beach ball around here, you know. So I'll give you one shot at this, because we're going to wrap up here in a minute and get ready for our big Thanksgiving festivities here. If you had to market something that had to do with brain development, okay? Now, it could be something that could be related to autism or related to and you wanted to communicate to people that had no freaking reason to know this, yet everyone has a brain. How would you, as a social media expert, communicate and get as enough people in this conversation as possible? Would you only go to the people that have the condition, or would you try to generalize it and pull those people in like a big net and sort out the tuna from the minnow, so to speak?
And the end game is to get people more aware of the issue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the end game is to get people to understand their brain design, because if they understand their brain design, it's going to affect their behavior, it's going to affect their social identity, it's going to affect how they age. It has all these things that are longitudinally beneficial, but on the immediate level, the only people that care about brain design are people that have bad brains. So
exactly.
Like you can go right to the bad brain community, and there's any number of these, you know, advocacy groups, but if I'm talking about, you know, brain design, and I'm out at the Google epicenter out there in Seattle, and I'm talking about brain design, saying, you know, you got to know if your user is visual or auditory or kinesthetic in the way that they learn, and it's like, how are you going to find that out? Well, you got to ask questions, and their interest in that is going to be much, much different than if I'm talking to a bunch of nursery school teachers that are dealing with kids learning to read. So how do you get a sort of a multimodal message out to a variety of these small groups that have a very limited need for information when you're not dovetailing, when you are getting the fondue fork out and you're just stabbing at the center of the square?
Yeah, I mean, my first take is, and this could be completely off, and that's the beauty of social media, is that you're going to get it wrong the first time you go out there. So the key is, you know, fail fast, fail forward, fail better. Get out there, learn, listen, and then so it's listen, interact, react, and then go from there. So the key is just get something out there. And my first stab would be, okay, how do I make this entertaining for the masses that might not even be aware of this? And it could be, I'm going to go do kind of quote-unquote the man on the street, Jay Leno type activity, where I'm just going to ask a bunch of questions about anything. Okay. And a lot of them might be brain-related, but I'm going to mix in some other stuff. And then what I might do is splice in, okay, this answer was probably – humorous, because this guy seems like a moron, but this is how this person's brain works, and then this person answered it differently. This is how this person's brain works, and so kind of working in that way where it's like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, that's why that guy answered it that way, this guy answered it this way, because this is how the different mechanisms of the brain work. And
you would make it a visual, entertaining, sort of a not like a lighthearted thing, and then annotate it with information underneath, so the people that are interested in the annotations follow you to the next iteration, and the ones who just want to laugh just pass it around at work, which always has that little tag on it to sort of kind of be the bait and the little lure to say, here's the candy, and then underneath, here's the actual information that's relevant to you. So, like in my situation, like dealing with brain design, if I told you I was going to create a jury and it was going to have Oprah and Britney Spears and Howard Stern on it, and I said two of these three brains are designed the same, guess which ones? And it was like, and then once you knew that, as a result of knowing that, you can go and identify five people around your Thanksgiving table that have similar brain designs. Is that something that what you're talking about? Is that you give them a reference that's common and easy, and then you give them a hook to say, if you want to know further, go here. So you're not invading them, you're not pitching to them, but you are educating them, you are engaging them, you are giving them something that they can easily pass on to somebody else. Hey, you know, I just found out Britney Spears has a really different brain than Christina Aguilera, yet they're both, you know, they're on the same level or Taylor Swift, something like that, where you break down popular people into a very sort of, I don't want to say unpopular, but very unknown sort of filter. And then that creates conversation. Is that kind of what you're telling me?
Yeah, I mean, I love your idea. That's very, you got to make information digestible. That's what most successful people are good at. And I love your Thanksgiving analogy, is why not, as part of that video, provide them with three questions that they can use around the table for fun and have everyone do it and fill it out if they're done eating and watching the Lions lose again. I'm a big Detroit Lions fan, so I can say that.
Hey, last week wasn't bad then.
No, it was great, except our quarterback, Stafford. It's Stafford. I heard you talking about it. It's Matthew Stafford that got hurt. But
is he not playing tomorrow? You have to put up with Culpepper?
I think so. I got to look at. Huh. I get off to go to the store. It's the expert, ESPN Fantasy Football Analysis.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you're going to go off and check your fantasy football now. So.
Yeah, got to check it. But I like your thought. I mean, that's one thing you dovetail is just to give three questions so that then they give it to their family, and then it gets them thinking about it, and they go, oh, that was fun and entertaining, and now you make that person look like a superstar that provided that value to that conversation. And then, oh, by the way, a
right.
little bit of information snuck in their head, and they said, oh, and here's another fun fact that I learned. And then that's
right.
Really
it's a dripping faucet as opposed to a fire hose, which is usually what
yep.
I do. So, okay. Well, I really want to thank you for going around the horn on me here tonight. You really put up with a lot of stuff. And, again, the book is Socialnomics. The site is socialnomics.net, I think. That's
yep.
your, okay. And,
.com or .net, they both get there.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You covered your bases. I made sure. I did com and net. Oh, here I am again. And you can check out the videos there. The great, easy little things you can pass along on your Facebook or, you know, tweet each other, whatever you want to do, because it gives you kind of a four-minute, like, holy cow, like, this is really happening kind of a thing, because the stats really tell the story. We're creating the stats here on the ground. So, you know, I thank you for joining us. Good luck with your fantasy football and your fancy Lions tomorrow, and good luck with the book and everything else, and thanks for stopping by here in Summertime.
No, thanks a lot for having me, and a happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
All right, man. Take care.
Have a good one.
Take care. All right. Got out just a spare couple of minutes here. Let's see. Now, I think I'm going to test this thing tonight because it says when you're streaming, and then it goes on the archive. So if I lose you in 3 minutes, don't despair, Sapiens. Just to kind of go back through our list, the guy I want to add to that list, like I was talking about before, is a guy named Joseph Moshe. Moshe. There's your sixth little piece of information. And he said out loud, the swine flu vaccine is a bioweapon. And he's another guy who called out this Baxter Labs. And then you can get into all things like the chemtrails and some of the other crap I've been reading about. He was abducted in Los Angeles and extradited back to Israel, and no one's heard of this guy in about a month now. So there you go. There's your little tidbit to take to your Thanksgiving table. So I like that idea. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll get that out to you guys later. And anybody have any questions, of course, you can get a hold of me at fancynakedsoma@gmail.com. All right, so I'm going to wind it down here on a Thanksgiving Eve. Get my friend over here, where are you, to sort of play us out. Next week, I have no freaking idea what we're doing.
You know what they say?
But I'll be back.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad.
Well, thank God,
other
yes.
things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life,
anybody again, you want to interact with me, you can go to somaspace.org, figure out what your
little
domain is. We talk to domains here. Next month, we're going to be getting into it. Eyeballs. All right, so travel light, my sapiens. Travel light to the here's my song for you.
Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten.
Go Giants.
And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing.
Forget
when you're
picks.
Feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse
the
your
Lions.
Lips and whistle. That's the thing.
Over the Packers.
They've always
Raiders
look on
point.
The right side
Big
of life.
And Big Blue.
Always look on
five, six
the,
and a half, the mountain.
Side of life.
That'll be at the game. There you go.
For life is quite absurd.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Final word.
Enjoy your
you
trip
to the
band.
Face the curtain
with
a bang.
Word. We're back next
look
Wednesday night at the
door. Give the audience a grin.
On the pneumonic tray. But until then.
Always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh, a death, a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you.
28
seconds. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Right, safety, man. Byron Zapians, you archiving mofos.